Welcome. It's wonderful to see your faces as always. So, every year, as we reread familiar passages of Torah, the same words can strike us in a completely new way if we're paying close attention. Of course, that's the secret. To create space in a busy day and enough emptiness in a busy mind. What Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind, to hear the words as if we hadn't already figured out what they meant or what we thought they meant. And when we do this, we may discover a new way of exploring and understanding the text. So this year, as we read this week, Parshat Truma, I heard the familiar phrase, Ve'asuli Mikdash, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh's instruction, let them make me a sanctuary, in a different way. Usually, the word that captures my attention is Mikdash, the sanctuary, the space that holds emptiness within, in contrast to the solid and lifelike object of the golden calf that entranced people to dance around it ecstatically and to worship it as an idol. The sanctuary is a structure for holding emptiness, a space within in which there's potential for intimate connection with God. But this year, my attention was captured by the verb to make or build on the creative process that people need to engage in together in order to make a dwelling for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh within their midst or within each of them. Ve'asuli mikdash v'shachanti bitocham. The word bitocham, let them build me a sanctuary and I will live. It could be bitocham, could be either within our midst, in this space created by all of us, or within each one of us. Each one of us having a potential space for the divine presence. So reading this familiar phrase with the emphasis on the asu, the action word, to make, to build, to create, it draws our attention to the active role that each of us needs to take in building a community of spiritual practice or in creating our own practice, creating space for our own practice in our lives. It's an emphasis that reminds us it's not the structure itself, it's not the finished product that's so important. Rather, it's the process of building, creating, working together collaboratively, working consistently, that is essential to make space for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh in everyday life. Not only do we have to build this together, as no one of us could create this on our own, just we always say it's easier to sit and meditate together than to do it on our own. And not only do the children of Israel have to do this as a group project, but they also are commanded to pay exquisite attention to every detail, some might say excruciating details, that are told in the first of these five parshiot. The first two are God telling Moses how to tell the people how to build the sanctuary. Then in the middle we have the golden calf, and then the two others that follow are about the actual building of it. So it's a repetition of all the same incredible details, the colors of each stone and gem, the measurements of each piece that's in the sanctuary, both in the building of the tent itself that contains the space, and every menorah and and all of the cherubim within. So we have, in fact, the Parshat, the Torah reading does not begin with the line, the famous line, Ve'asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. It begins with a long and detailed list out of nowhere of the remarkable gifts of gold, silver, copper, purple, blue, crimson, yarns, fine linen, goat's hair, dolphin skins, acacia wood, oil for lighting, spices for anointing, and aromatic incense, lapis lazuli, and other stones for the ephod and the breastpiece. And so, what's the context of this? Because right before, at the end of last week's Torah reading, the people witness that God has called Moses. God has called out of the midst of the cloud that was covering Mount Sinai. The presence of the Lord appeared in the sight of the Israelites as a consuming fire on top of the mountain. And Moses went inside the cloud and ascended the mountain, and Moses remained on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. So no wonder the Israelites got so anxious about their leader being away longer than they expected. They just watched him being swallowed up by a consuming fire. And in the very next line, we get to overhear the beginning of our Torah reading for this week. We overhear God giving Moses a long shopping list, so to speak, a list of the gifts that the people will give when moved by their hearts for building and adorning the sanctuary. From this, we can infer that there is something important about the people freely giving their own precious possessions. Of course, the backstory, much of this was taken from the Egyptians, and that, of course, could be another drash. But it's very important for them to follow extremely detailed directions very precisely, as one has to in building a structure according to a blueprint. As I was reviewing this Torah reading, I was at a talk and a quote from William James appeared on the screen in a lecture, the lecture that I was attending, which was about a program for treating teens with depression. And the quote was, "My experience is what I agree to attend to." And this is from William James' Principles of Psychology. The quote reminds us that ideally, we have a choice about what we attend to. And of course, we all know how the things that we pay attention to, the scripts that we rerun in our heads, the headlines that grab us, the glittering appeal of new luxuries, or the guilt that torments about something that went wrong, all these create the experience that we live in. So, in this Torah reading, in the context of recent trauma, as the children of Israel had just left their homes in Israel, been pursued by the Egyptians, fearing they'd be killed by the Egyptians, having to walk through the Red Sea, then fearing they'll die in the desert. Like, what did we get here for? Just to die of thirst in the desert? In the context of this, of course, their minds would be drawn again and again back to the terror of these moments that they had lived through, and the terror of the uncertainty of where they were going. And then on top of that, the terror of having their leader disappear into a consuming cloud of fire. So perhaps as a therapeutic intervention, God commanded them to pay exquisite attention to every detail, the color of each stone, the measure of each piece of wood, the clasps and the handles of gold, silver, copper. Each command drawing them back to the present moment of building collaboratively, lest their minds wander back to Egypt. But why all these fantastic colors and materials? Aviva Zornberg has a beautiful commentary on this based on the Midrash about God's instructions to Moses on Mount Sinai. That God showed Moses up above a red fire, a green fire, a black fire, a white fire, and told him, "Make it according to the pattern that you are being shown on the mountain." Rav Berachia, in the name of Rav Batzla, said, "This is like a king." There's always a story about a king, right? "This is like a king who had a splendid garment made of jewels, and he said to his servant, 'Make me one just like it.' And the servant, bewildered, wondering how could he make such a garment without having the glory of so many rare and precious jewels, the jewels that made up the king's garment. The servant asks, 'My lord the king, can I make one like it?' And the king replied, 'I remain in my glory, but you have your materials.'" Similarly, Moses says to God, "My God, can I make anything like these fires?" Of course, Moses has no idea how to make something with these otherworldly fires, especially on earth. And God said, "If you make what is above below, I shall leave my palace above and descend and condense my presence among them below." So Moses, like the king's servant, and like all of us, needs to find the earthly materials that are available to us right here, that are already within our possession, whatever gifts we have, to create a space for the divine presence in our midst. God reassures Moses, and Moses tells the people, "You have the materials at hand to create space for the presence of the divine." God tells Moses, Moses tells the people this. So what does it mean for each of us to take the materials we have at hand to create a space that is both empty enough and vibrant enough to represent God's dwelling place on earth, a place that can contain holiness? If we think about this in terms of material dwelling places, after all, we do like to worship within a structure, particularly in the midst of winter. So real structures in our community, of course, we think of the architecture and the design of the places we worship in. When communities have the means, they try to create a space with materials that represent our concept of the divine presence on earth. The commandments forbid, of course, any likenesses of idols, any attempt to represent God, the unrepresentable Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. That would be a reenactment of the golden calf catastrophe. But the Mishkan and buildings like TBZ are designed with materials and objects like the menorah, the Ner Tamid, the enduring flame, that call our attention to an imaginary ideal of glory, to the magnificent beauty and warmth of our ideal of infinite compassion and forgiveness. With earthly materials, we try to represent symbolically in our midst an ideal and universal beauty that we can only imagine because it doesn't exist in the material world. But of course, if we move beyond the material building of a Mishkan, the idea of creating space in our lives, metaphorically for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, has infinite reverberations in all the ways we intentionally make room in our communities, in our families, in our homes, in our minds, in our hearts, in our lives, for what we value most, that we imagine the ideals that we imagine existing in a universal way, like compassion, loving kindness, taking joy in the good fortune of others, equanimity, to name a few. And these happen to be the four Brahma Viharas, also called the sublime attitudes or divine abodes. Again, it's abode, this a dwelling place, a place that can be inhabited by these ideal values. And an abode within us for these values. So in the Buddhist tradition, that these four Brahma Viharas are loving kindness, the sincere desire for the well-being and happiness of ourselves and all beings, karuna, compassion, the different from loving kindness, which is the desire for the happiness of everyone. Compassion is understood here as empathy and the active desire to relieve the suffering of others. Mudita, sympathetic joy, genuinely rejoicing in the success and good fortune of others. The opposite of Schadenfreude, for which I don't think there is a word in Buddhist spiritual practice. Not even one word to define it in English. And upeka, equanimity, maintaining a balanced, steady mind, not easily swayed by bias, aversion, or clinging to the things that we like. So these four states represent an ideal way of living, reducing our focus on the self as a solid, separate thing, cultivating a boundless heart that's attuned to the interconnectedness of everything. So, how do we do this in our daily lives? Some of us do this through service to community, through activism and letter writing, bringing food to a Shiva minion, helping with Torah reading. Some of us focus more on cultivating these qualities in ourselves through meditation practice, which literally creates an empty space in our busy lives and busy minds. We create emptiness and spaciousness in meditation by paying careful attention first to the form, again, the structure, the scaffolding of the skeleton that holds us up as we sit. Having a schedule where we have a time in the day, arranging the schedule, structuring the time, and paying attention to the quality of the breathing body with each breath. Just as the Mishkan building crew had to pay attention to every cubit they measured. And so, as we all engage in this project together, we build our virtual Mishkan, which, like the Mishkan in this Torah reading, can travel anywhere with us, carrying the spirit of spacious awareness wherever we go. So, in this building process, we experience qualities of the divine within ourselves, dedication to something greater than ourselves. So, of course, I extend thanks to all of you for participating in this particular building project, building a community that sits together, creating an empty space, and inviting awareness of the divine into our midst. And I personally feel appreciative because this shared building project has created a space for me to engage in the most rewarding practice of putting together drashas like this, an opportunity to reflect and open ourselves to new ways of understanding this ancient text that's been an inspiration to people for so many hundreds of years. And I highly recommend drasha writing as one of the best ways to create this space in our lives. And on a practical level, because we are human, we do this most effectively when we have an assignment, like writing a talk for a Friday morning and a deadline. We rarely undertake such a project without having a deadline. And for me, having to write these talks has been a very rewarding and palpable way to create space for spiritual practice in my life. So I encourage all of you to join in this aspect of the building project. We appreciate everyone who has contributed and who will contribute. And I'm happy to consult to anyone who has an idea, and if you feel it's not really related to the parsha, it doesn't matter. Either it's just something that means a lot to you and it'll mean a lot to us if you share it with us, or if you feel compelled to figure out how to connect it to something about the Torah or the calendar cycle, we can figure out a way. There's always a way. So, I will close with a poem that Aviva Zornberg read in her commentary on this parsha, and it resonates with the theme of dwelling within. The Torah reminds us that the Spirit of God dwells within us, and the amazing poet Emily Dickinson reminds us that we can dwell within the divine. And the title of this poem is I Dwell in Possibility. So I'm going to share this. So let's see if I can do that quickly. Share. Okay. Can you all see this? Okay. I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose. More numerous of windows, superior for doors. Of chambers as the cedars, impregnable of eye, and for an everlasting roof, the gambrels, the windows of the sky. Of visitors, the fairest, for occupation, this, the spreading wide my narrow hands to gather. Paradise. So I'll go through it with a bit of commentary. I dwell in possibility. This idea of dwelling in this sense of the possibility of anything emerging. A fairer house than prose, more numerous of windows, superior for doors. So here, there's this emphasis on the openness, the emptiness, the transparency. And then suddenly, the opposite of chambers is the cedars, impregnable of eye. So, chambers that you can't get into. This is like the Mishkan, also. It was an empty space, but it was one that you couldn't just walk into. You had to be the high priest prepared. Over a whole, through a whole series of ritual practices to once a year enter the Mishkan. So it's both completely open and empty and also impregnable, which kind of captures that I guess koan of Jewish practice and Jewish imagery about Yud-Heh Vav-Heh. And for an everlasting roof, the gambrels of the sky, kind of really relating to this heavenly image. Of visitors, the fairest. Okay, so who is being invited in? Is this Emily Dickinson's drash on Ve'asuli Mikdash, creating space for the divine? For occupation, this is this her poetry. But again, the spreading of my narrow hands, that our earthly materials are narrow, they're small. But we use them to gather materials that in some way resonate or represent paradise. So I may leave that up there. Well, I'll stop our share for the moment, and we can go back to it later if we want to. But I will finish with the words of the Kotzker Rebbe. When asked, Where does God dwell? The Katzke Rebbe answered, wherever you let God in.